race is on, and the inaugural Tuscan Grand Prix at Mugello brought red flags, good racing and recriminations aplenty after just 12 drivers made it to the end of a race that took 2 hours and 19 minutes to complete. Up front, it was a familiar story as Lewis Hamilton took his 6th win of the season, while Mercedes teammate Valtteri Bottas ended up disappointed again. I'm Ed Straw, and joining me to look back on the race are Scott Mitchell and Mark Hughes. Now, Mark, first and foremost, this was a Grand Prix with a crowd, wasn't it, for the first time this year? So I presume it was the normal Italian F1 crowd who mobbed anyone unfortunate enough to be wearing a red shirt, or was it all a little bit more calm and socially distanced?
Yeah, you had to look hard to see whether there were. It was just a little selection of the Ferrari fan club, and they were had their own little bit that was distanced from everyone else. And yeah, I think it was 3,000 of them there, but they were spread out. So yeah, at least it's marked a little tick on the bedposts on the return back to normality. But let's see.
And Scott Mitchell, you were watching from afar. Obviously, it's great to see Mugello, isn't it, having a Grand Prix. It's the first time there's been F1 cars racing there, not just World Championship, but for anything.
Yeah, it's great. I think there was a lot of there's a very romantic view of Mugello before this race, and I think we were all looking forward to what the cars would look like on track, and then the spectacle of qualifying. And I think I probably speak for the majority when I say I didn't have huge hopes for the race itself, but I think from start to finish, I've really enjoyed this weekend. It's just nice to have a track where pretty much anywhere they are on track, it's quite enjoyable to watch it. It was brilliant having a circuit with that kind of runoff grass and gravel that really, really punished drivers for even just running wide, not just crashing, but just going off. And then I also think that the characteristics of the circuit had a very, very important role in the slightly chaotic race that we saw at times, and the fact that it was actually quite an engaging Grand Prix from start to finish. So yeah, absolute full marks to Mugello. What an F1 debut.
Well, people are not going to forget this race, are they? That's for sure. So there's lots for us to delve into. Now, Scott, I'm going to suggest before we get into what I'm going to call a race proper, we probably need to tackle that big talking point, which was the accident at the first restart at the end of lap 6. This led to 12 drivers being warned for their part in causing it, but Carlos Sainz, Nicholas Latifi, Kevin Magnussen and Antonio Giovinazzi out of the race. So it's fair to say this was the big talking point after the race among drivers and teams, wasn't it?
Well, it was the big talking point from the moment it happened. So I think obviously during the red flag period that it triggered, it was subject of a lot of attention. There were some quite strong comments, I think, even being issued by the drivers over the team radio as it happened. I should never underestimate a racing driver's ability to get on the radio while they're in the middle of a massive crash, which I think it was at least Nicholas Latifi did. I think he was on the radio while his car was still being hit, which is quite impressive. But yeah, it wiped out four cars, and it ended up in this with these 12 warnings. It was all a legacy of two things really. The drivers and the FIA are sort of at odds over what the responsibility is, but it comes down to what the drivers feel is the safety car lights coming out too late, so that in this case, the race leader was Valtteri Bottas, so he basically then has to back the cars up on the start finish straight. He can't do it before the final corner and then blitz it and gap the cars behind. So he basically keeps a slow pace all the way up to the start finish line, which is the second point, because that's quite far down at Mugello. So it's sort of this unique situation, which then just basically led to a bunch of drivers getting caught out. It was like that accordion effect where the field sort of like compresses and then goes apart again and then compresses again, and you have cars all over the place. It just becomes a bit of a nightmare, to be honest. Predictable, I thought, and it seems that a few of the drivers thought it was predictable as well, and yet here we are. Predictable as it may have been, it was still allowed to play out and happen, and yeah, I think we were lucky that no one got hurt, to be honest, because it's quite a frightening incident.
Now, we've heard lots of people being blamed and the finger being pointed at them. Some people blame Valtteri Bottas, obviously. Others blame some of the drivers going quick towards the back. Are you going to really heavily point the finger at anyone, or do you just accept that because of those circumstances you've talked about, it has to just be everyone's responsible and it was circumstances?
I thought, looking at various onboards, I thought that you know, there were a couple like Kvyat and Russell that were maybe sort of offenders because they left quite a big gap in front of them. And then they sort of, that was it then. That was when they interpreted the race to be starting. So they gunned it on the throttle. And then they had to back out of it again because they realised that it hadn't. And I felt that they were arguably two of the biggest offenders. I thought that Kvyat was the first one really to do it in that way. But the FIA have ruled that no one was predominantly to blame because there were 12 drivers that all their actions are interlinked, and you've got these other circumstances at play as well. So it was just an incident where you can probably point to any one of the drivers that have been warned and say it was your fault, and then they'll turn around and say that they were responding to somebody else.
Yeah, there's a heavy ripple effect, isn't there? What do you think, Mark? Obviously, there was some pointing the finger at the FIA's desire to have the safety car lights going off too late. Do you think that had that been more conventional and they had more warning, this wouldn't have happened? So does the blame lie in race control?
I think it does on this occasion. I mean, it usually doesn't. They're usually very good. But I think on this occasion, it goes back to Baku a couple of years ago where they had that great restart where Vettel hit the back of Hamilton. Basically, the great big gap there that you have after being released from the safety car resulted in this, the leader being very, very vulnerable down to the first corner. And they liked this. They thought it was made for a good spectacle. And it's true that you do see usually very little position change on a restart. And so they were wanting to spice it up a bit. And so they have been getting later and later in how late they turn the lights off. Now, that's significant because conventionally, when you turn them off, well earlier on the lap, the leader is allowed to drop more than 10 car lengths back from the safety car. When the safety car has its lights on, he has to remain 10 cars or less within the back of the safety car. But as soon as you put the lights out, you can drop back and create the space for yourself to get a jump on your pursuers. But if you turn that light out so late in the lap, the leader can't do that. And so with the layout that we have at Mugello, as Scott said, there's a great big gap between the safety car line, which is pretty much at the beginning of the straight, and the start-finish line, which is nearly a kilometre later. It's 800 meters later. The only way of defending yourself is to do what he did, which is just crawl up all the way up there, compress the field that way, and then go when you get the start-finish line, which is nearly the end of the straight. Because if you don't do that as the leader, you're going to get slipstreamed. You're going to be toast. You're probably going to get passed by at least one car. So the teams knew this, or certainly the teams that were likely to be up the front in this situation had already worked out that's what they would do in this situation and instructed the drivers accordingly. They'd watched situations in the F3 and the F2 race there, and they had observed that the only time the leader was able to defend himself was when he did exactly that. When the leader hadn't done that, when he just done it conventionally, he was toast. So they knew this. And I think it was pointed out to them, but in trying to balance off the spectacle with the safety, I think they got it a little bit wrong on this occasion and got away with it, thankfully. And hopefully it will influence their future judgment on it.
Yeah, well, there's certainly going to be lots of talking about it, and this will have to be tackled. They'll have to come up with some way to prevent it. And I do feel sorry for some of the guys down the back, because they end up looking like lunatics, don't they, when you've got someone like Giovinazzi just piling into cars. But obviously, because the effect is multiplied as you go down the order to everyone reacting, and then you get a bunch of people basically stopped. There were sort of cars three wide at one point. There's inevitably this intersection where the reaction time of the people at the back to inputs that have happened ages before, they just can't do anything. So you end up with this unfortunate kind of effect. But it could have been a lot more serious. When you get cars going into the back of each other, obviously there's the very robust rear crash structure there as well, so you're hitting something quite hard. It's sort of serious business, especially when we saw cars being flicked up, and big old accident, wasn't it?
Yeah, you see the Alfa up in the air there with its rear wheel very close to the cockpit of the Latifi's car, and Sainz was thrown up there as well. Yeah, you're in the lap of the gods then. So, yeah, it was just luck, really. Yeah, we have got some, these super effective active safety with the halo and the crash structure, but doesn't make you indestructible.
Yeah, which is exactly why creating situations at restarts to spice up the show, as it were, perhaps going a little bit too far in terms of the danger created, then maybe you need to have a bit more of a serious think about it. But it was something that played a big part in defining the race. So I guess it's one of the big reasons why we're going to remember the race at Mugello, if that's the only one that we ever have. But I suppose in terms of solutions, they're going to have to come up with a point where the safety car has to turn its lights off by on a lap or something in order to give the necessary warning, so that if they can't push it late. I guess there aren't actually that many tracks where this is that big a problem, because Mugello, as you said, has an unusual configuration. And there's a lot of other tracks where there's less of a natural flow almost. It's a bit more stop-start, so it'd be easier to implement.
Yeah, I think probably this one and Baku are the two obvious ones where you could get a situation.
Yeah, well, that's something for the FIA to delve into in the future, and I'm sure we're going to hear plenty of talk about that by the time we get to Sochi for the next race in Russia. But there was a race going on around that. That, of course, was the first restart after the safety car. So let's have a look up front, Mark, because this was another one of those races where Valtteri Bottas flattered to deceive. He didn't quite have enough for Hamilton. Familiar story, fastest in the three practice sessions, fastest in Q1, and then Hamilton nudged ahead in Q2, then he got pole. Bottas was ahead in the race at one stage. It did seem, though, at the time, he was destined for victory, though, didn't it?
There were little glimpses of it. I mean, we didn't get to see how if he could have got pole or not, because he was denied his final Q3 run by the yellow flags for Ocon spin. So he still had that lap to go, and he was, within sniffing distance of Hamilton then anyway. So he may have started from pole, but as it was, he made a better start from the original start than Hamilton was leading anyway. So, once you're in the lead in a car, pretty much the same, if in the normal running of a race without safety cars and things like that, and a team that doesn't allow them to use one against the other in terms of favourable strategies or whatever, then it would have been quite difficult for Valtteri to have lost that race. But of course, we got the safety car, and then we give Lewis another bite at the cherry, and he did it on the restart at turn one, just opted for the outside. The car was sliding around his correct nose steer as he went around Valtteri's outside. Valtteri was just a little bit passive, just not very hard. He didn't treat Lewis as if he was a competitor. He treated him as if he was a teammate, and this is a guy who's supposed to be fighting for the world championship. It was a bit disappointing.
Yeah, we do see that a lot with Bottas, though, don't we? It's one of those things, I think, you can work at it a little bit, but it's either in your nature to be the one who's really, really combative wheel to wheel, or you're not. And I think Bottas is almost too gentlemanly in those situations sometimes, and it's quite hard to force yourself to be something you're not in those pressure situations, unfortunately. But I would say, ultimately, although he didn't get that second run in Q3, ultimately, had he been quicker than Hamilton on the first runs in Q3, he'd have been on pole. So, he had equal opportunity, should we say. They both had one run in that session, so one of those things. But Scott, there was a little bit of confusion, because obviously Bottas was requesting to go opposite to Hamilton in terms of the tyre choice and that kind of thing. And then I think they ended up on the same tyres at the next stop, didn't they? So what did Toto Wolff have to say about the whole thing?
Well, it was more that Bottas wanted to go... he wanted to go offset, obviously, because he knew that in a straight fight it was going to be very difficult to overtake Hamilton. But the problem was he was having... he was having a problem with the tyres in that he was starting to suffer some vibrations. I think he said the front left was basically gone, and was struggling in a not dissimilar fashion to at Silverstone, where obviously those front left punches occurred for Bottas, Hamilton, and Carlos Sainz. So Mercedes had to pit Bottas first as a precaution. I think by this point Lewis had stretched into like a 6 or 7 second lead. So Bottas didn't have the option to go opposite to Hamilton, because in that situation, I think you need to react to what Hamilton's doing. I don't think Bottas can't dictate what tyres Mercedes put Hamilton on as the second car. So as soon as he comes into the pit first, he forfeits his opportunity to go and do something different to Lewis. And as soon as that happened, it was basically locked in. They were in stay off the curbs mode again. But unlike in, if you remember Austria, it was all about gearbox sensors and electrical noise and stuff like this. And here it was just being a bit cautious, didn't want to trigger a puncture or something like that. So it wasn't that the Mercedes went into, no, you're not allowed to race mode, but it was basically, can you race but without driving too aggressively, which I'm sure Formula One drivers take very kindly to. But yeah, it wasn't like a controversy or something. I don't think it was like Mercedes trying to stitch up Bottas and deny him the crack at Hamilton that he wanted. It was just the way the race played out. He didn't have the opportunity that he was looking for.
Yeah, I think the tire problem was very serious. It was a level of vibration. It turned out it was from the right front. It was a level of vibration in excess of what they'd seen at the first Silverstone just before the tyre blew. So they were very, very aware that this thing is liable to go at any moment. Basically, the problem was where, because there was very little deg, surprisingly, around this track. And we'll come on to that later, because it's quite an interesting outcome. But so the problem then becomes where you just wear the tyre out. And the first signs of that are the vibration, because it doesn't wear evenly across the tread. It wears more on one than another side. And as you get this increasing mismatch, you get an increasing vibration. And that's usually the sign that it's about to go. So they couldn't leave him out there. So he had to be brought in immediately. He lost those, I think he was 1.5 seconds behind, and then that just ballooned up to like 5 or 6 seconds within about 3 laps, and that was when it was, you know, on its last legs. And so they brought him in, and at that point, when you've got that concern, you're not going to mess about anymore. They just stuck him on a set of hards, and they put Lewis on the same a lap later. And Lewis didn't want to come in at that point because he said, my tyres are fine, and they just said, no, we've got Valtteri in already for safety issues, so we're bringing you in next. And that was it. It was neutralised. The tyre thing never... It never developed into a competition between them because of what had happened with Valtteri's right front.
Well, let's quickly talk a little bit about the tyres and why it was unusual characteristics. Obviously, Mugello, lots of long, high-energy corners. It is a high-energy circuit in terms of the demand on the tyres. It's actually closest to Silverstone in terms of the stresses it puts on the tyres. And yet, as you say, the deg wasn't much of a problem. It was wear-limited. We didn't see, you know, the blistering we saw at the second Silverstone race. There weren't any of those things you sort of can go wrong with the tyres, generally weren't.
Yeah, and it was very interesting. And it took pretty much everyone by surprise. Even after the race, engineers were saying, I really don't understand why for sure. But there are a couple of theories which I think hold a lot of water. One is that it's a very old-school track surface with very open pores, a bit like Suzuka. And when you have the very smooth modern surfaces, it doesn't penetrate very, very far into the tyre's tread. And so you're putting all the load on a very thin part of it's not penetrating very deep. So that top layer is doing all the work, if you like, and it overheats. And that's when you start to get the thermal deg, where you just lose performance, even though there's plenty of tread on the tyre. So that wasn't happening. So that could well be because of the more open nature of the track surface. And I did speak with Ross Brawn about this and asked for his observation. He said it was something that they very much were looking at. And in the future, when circuits are resurfaced, they're definitely going to be looking at recreating a more old-school type of surface. So it could be that this problem that Pirelli's been getting the blame for is not entirely Pirelli's fault. And it may be just the modern surfaces that are sort of been exacerbating the problem. But the other thing is that there's very little braking at Mugello. So you're not really combining lateral load with braking loads, and maybe this is having a bigger effect than had been realised in driving the thermal deck, that overlapping of the longitudinal with the lateral. There's only six braking points, even though there's 15 corners. There's only six braking points. There's also fast and flowing. The lowest gear you're in is fourth gear on the whole lap. So maybe this was another reason why the tyres were just being allowed to breathe a little bit, even though they were being loaded up laterally massively, they were quite happy there.
Yeah, it's a good point, because even though it's quite a lot of lateral load with traction events, but not the braking events. So yeah, there's something I'll be able to learn from there. But ultimately, this was a race in which tyres also played a role, and Valtteri Bottas was on the wrong side of it again, and that sort of sums it up, doesn't it? He's just a little bit a step behind Lewis Hamilton in some of those areas. As we said before, Hamilton's an all-time great. Hard work for Valtteri Bottas. Before we move on to the rest of it, Scott, we should just talk about the man most likely to challenge them, Max Verstappen. He had all sorts of dramas before the race, and then obviously he was taken out by the Raikkonen Gasly Grosjean collision behind, sort of catching up with him on the run to turn two. So what actually was going on with Verstappen, engine problem wise or some other related problem he had?
Well, he actually had three issues, because the issue that we saw when he reported a concern on his way to the grid in one of his reconnaissance laps, and you would have seen the frantic work that was going on sort of like the left rear part of the car or the left hand side of the car with a swarm of mechanics around it. But that wasn't actually a Honda issue as seemed to be sort of indicated at the time. It was a separate issue that Red Bull were trying to solve. But then when Max got away and started his formation lap, it seems that over the course of the formation lap, there was something that emerged on the data and sort of indicated it'd be a problem. But Max only experienced that when he put his foot down at the start and got a really decent initial launch, was just about to blast past Lewis Hamilton, take second and maybe challenge Bottas. And then basically in the second phase of the start, it was a bit of a GP2 engine, unfortunately. He sort of went nowhere. Loads of cars went past him. He was in the midfield by turn one, and then issue number three strikes as he comes out of the first corner and goes into the chicane, brakes, minds his own business, and then gets absolutely rear-ended because three drivers, was it Raikkonen, Gasly and Grosjean, acted like they'd never been in a Formula 1 race in the midfield before, and basically all just pretty much just charged into each other, which Verstappen was just a completely innocent victim. I was riding on board at the time, and so I had his team radio open, and I don't think I've heard Max react that way in a really long time. The bad start to begin with, that he basically screamed down the radio, and then when he got pitched into the gravel, he swore instantly. I can't remember the exact words that he used, but he basically just said it was an absolute shambles, and that's what you get when you're surrounded by those sorts of people, basically. So yeah, he was out on the spot, but he was expecting to retire anyway because of the engine issue that had arisen off the line. So yeah, it was pretty miserable 15-20 seconds of the Tuscan Grand Prix really for him.
Yeah, and a second consecutive retirement, so he's 80 points down in the championship. Now, I don't think we really thought he was a serious contender, but there's always the chance if you hang on in there. But he's now thoroughly not hung on in there through probably little fault of his own. So, yeah, that's Verstappen. Yeah, a bad couple of weekends in Italy for him. But, Scott, while it's not been a foregone conclusion that when one Red Bull driver hits trouble, the other one will step into the breach, Alex Albon did manage to do that by taking the third place in the race that Max Verstappen would have probably been destined for with a healthy car. Finally, Albon's first breakthrough F1 podium. And of course, he had to make it hard for himself, didn't he? Dropping for seventh at the first restart. He's not willing to do this the easy way, is he?
No, he made properly hard work of this. I think we were all thinking before the race, right, Mugello is a track that's difficult to overtake. Red Bull's got clearly the second fastest car here, like big buffer to the cars behind. He's starting fourth. He hasn't biffed qualifying. This is it. This is the boring race he needs. And then he just finds himself sort of mugged at the start. He gets a bit of a reprieve because Verstappen's fallen back. So he's sort of like, okay, here's an opportunity. Slips back further. I think he was down to seventh at one point, gets back up. And then when you've got like that final restart, he's fourth, Ricciardo's third, and you're thinking, right, here you go. This is your chance. Good launch. Good first run. Just make it easy for yourself. Nope, he spends the first lap of the restart trying to fight off the remaining racing point and actually make fourth his own. In the end, the overtakes that he pulled and the way he got his elbows out to salvage his drive was fantastic. But it's like, it's kind of like your own worst enemy in that situation, Alex, because you're having to overcome hurdles that shouldn't be in your way. But he did a really good job, I think, to make the most of the car that was under him and actually in the end score a relatively comfortable podium over the last sort of 10 laps or so. It was pretty easy to sort of just keep Ricciardo at arm's length once he was gone. And yeah, I was happy for him. I think he's had some bad luck. He hasn't driven great at times, but this has been coming. This isn't out of the blue. The last three events, there's been marked improvement in what he's been doing. We've just been waiting for him to actually execute a full weekend and have a trouble-free race, and fair play to him. After, as we say, making it hard for himself, that's exactly what he did.
Yeah, well, I spoke to him on Saturday night after qualifying, and he said that he felt the progress has been there. It hasn't just hasn't quite come together. And although even then qualifying wasn't perfect, he was at least up in fourth place. So let's hope that just eases some of the pressure. He doesn't have to keep grasping for that first podium, hopefully the first of many for Alex Albon. Mark, there were two other drivers in that battle for third at various times, with both Lance Stroll and Ricciardo holding the position for a time. Let's have a look at Ricciardo first, because he was passed on the 51st of 59 laps. So has he got any reason to be disappointed? This wasn't that long-awaited revived Renault Works team podium?
No, not really. He was out of position, really, being as high as third in the first place. Alex was in a much faster car, and I think he understood that. He didn't really fight it when Alex came past him. He went around the outside of turn one, and he didn't even crowd him out because it was inevitable that he was going to get him somewhere. So he just let him go and just concentrate on making his race as clean as possible, because at that point, Perez was still within striking distance. And so, yeah, he was just concentrating on keeping it clean and keeping that gap back to Perez. So, no, I think that was pretty much the maximum result that could have been expected from him, really. It was a pretty immaculate performance all round.
Yeah, it's just a little bit of a shame that he hadn't been able to string the lap together in qualifying, because that one Q3 run he had a little bit of a couple of moments actually, and just he felt he could have been fifth, but ended up down in eighth place. I guess we should briefly mention in passing Esteban Ocon, who didn't even make the first standing restart, should we say, because he had rear brake problems that manifested themselves early on in the race and under the safety car. So one of those weekends for Ocon, because he was actually looking pretty handy compared to Ricciardo, and then whether this was related to the fact he was just pushing a little bit too hard, he had that spin at the end of Q3 that caused this these yellow flags. I think there's some promising signs there for Ocon, but still, it's been a really tough first half of the season for him, hasn't it, Mark? Just not really delivering what we know he can.
He's just not quite at Daniel's pace, is he? And this is the closest he's been in the dry. He was quicker in the wet at Austria too, but this is the closest he's got. I think he's making progress, but I've yet to be convinced that he's a driver of Ricciardo's calibre.
Well, there aren't many of those around, are there, certainly? So there'd be no shame in that. Now, Lance Stroll mentioned he was up there in third at one stage. Ricciardo undercut his way past him. There was a brief hope at one stage that Kvyat might hold up Ricciardo enough for Stroll to edge back ahead. Hence, they left him out a little bit longer before that first stop, but it wasn't to be. But then Stroll had the crash at Zarrabiata 2, the fast right-hander, wasn't it? Now, we don't seem to have a definitive answer from the team on this, but there was clearly something appeared to come off the front left, and there seemed to be some kind of tyre problem as a result. It's not really clear exactly what the sequence of events was, other than it doesn't appear to have been Lance Stroll's fault.
No, that's right. He was pushing hard at the time that it happened, but it just went very, very suddenly. And he didn't have a wheel on the gravel or anything like that, which is what we assumed initially. But no, it just seems something had gone wrong. He felt it was a puncture. It was difficult to tell when you looked at the wreckage of the car, because the left rear was flat, but it may have been flat as a result of hitting the barrier, we don't know. So yeah, just unfortunate. It was one of those things, probably tire related.
Yeah, there was definitely stuff flying around anyway. So ultimately, not his fault. He was holding, what, fourth place at the time, chasing Ricciardo, wasn't he? So and he also had Albon behind him. So interesting little battle that was playing out there. But reasonable showing for Racing Point. We should briefly, before we move on, mention the fact that they had a few upgrades on Stroll's car, didn't they, Mark, with the interesting brake ducts that, that caught the eye, as well as a few other changes that didn't quite go in the Mercedes direction.
Yeah, the brake ducts. They've ditched the 2019... front brake ducts, and they've come up with their own brake ducts, which look remarkably like the 2020 Mercedes brake ducts. So it's just, you know, the regulation, the clarification that came out as a result of the protests and appeals was that they supplied through 2021, so they're just ploughing on with the original plan in regard with this year's car, and they clearly take inspiration still from Mercedes, and they've been looking very hard at this year's car, obviously. But in other areas, notably in the side pod shaping, they've developed in their own direction. It looks more like a Red Bull philosophy, what they've done. So they you know, they've taken that W10 as the starting point and developed in their own direction, which is what they said they'd always do.
And the positive thing is it does seem to have worked, because we saw in the race Stroll, although he'd qualified behind Perez, I think Perez had just done a better job of getting what he could out of the car in qualifying before Stroll missed out on his second run anyway. Perez only had one run because he only had one set of tyres. But we did see a marked step difference in pace between Perez and Stroll in the race, consistent with this 2 to maybe 3 tenths that the team thinks it's found.
Yes, I mean, they, run for run, Stroll's car looked quicker all through the weekend. He got through Q1 and Q2 with just one set of tyres. Sergio needed a couple of sets to be sure each time, which is why he only had one set left for Q3 and Lance had two. So, it was just clearly quite an effective upgrade, which is what they'd expected. It tallied with what they saw in the tunnel.
And, of course, the periphery of this battle for the top six, or at the bottom of it, Lando Norris finished sixth behind Perez with Ricciardo fourth. There isn't actually much to say about Norris because he started 11th. He drove around, he got ahead of Ocon at the start, and then he just picked up places when people hit trouble. Perfectly solid drive, but just not much to talk about there. Which means, Scott, we can now move on to AlphaTauri, because last week we were talking about an AlphaTauri win, and Daniel Kvyat's seventh place in comparison to that win doesn't sound much, but it's a pretty good return for the team. But as for Gasly, he went from hero to zero, didn't he? Because while you said when you're talking about Verstappen, who was taken out in the crash, you had those three, Raikkonen and Grosjean and Gasly battling. It was Gasly who went into a gap that was never going to stay there and really created that collision.
Yeah, it was just a disastrous disastrous weekend when it mattered for Pierre, who'd been super quick. I think he'd been no lower than eighth through the free practice sessions. I think he was actually fifth in free practice, and was in really good shape going into qualifying. And then a combination of some setup misjudgment, both with the car and then the energy recovery system as well. The deployment of the battery, he ran out of charge basically, a couple of hundred meters too early, and which cost him on the run to the line. So he got knocked out in Q1, which is P1 1 week, out in Q1 the next. And unlike Monza, where I think he went from, I think it was a 10th on the grid to win, aided by some strategy shenanigans, he never even had a chance to make most of the chaos of today's race, because he was, as you say, Ed, primarily responsible for the first bit of chaos that actually started it all, because obviously safety cars breed safety cars, don't they? And it was this incident that triggered it all at the very beginning.
Yeah, I think he was just so determined to make up for what happened in qualifying that he didn't really think, because he did move into that gap at the exit of turn one between Raikkonen and Grosjean. It just went wrong for all of them as a result. So, yeah, unfortunate for Gasly. But the point you made about the struggles they had in qualifying, this is an interesting wider point about going to Mugello, because obviously things like the ERS strategy for qualifying and how you chase the evolving track during qualifying, they're things that teams build up a lot of experience of. And AlphaTauri was actually one of the teams that struggled a bit, because they didn't quite go with the amount of front end they needed in order to get the best out of the car as the track kind of gripped up. So that's a little footnote to what visiting a new and unfamiliar track adds, because they don't have all that historic data to rely on. So it just creates a little bit more of a window for people to fall out of, as it were, in terms of just not quite getting things right. But for Kvyat, seventh place, I mean, it's a bit like Norris, actually, his race, because he started behind Norris and he sort of finished behind him and didn't do a great deal in the race, but at least kept out of trouble and banked his best result of the season. So that's positive for Kvyat, at least, who's sort of the support act at AlphaTauri these days. Well, I should apologise at this point because I have been a bit remiss so far, because we've waited far too long to talk about the real star of this show, which was Ferrari. It was its anniversary weekend, the 1,000th World Championship race start, allegedly. Charles Leclerc, 8th. Sebastian Vettel, 10th. Mark Hughes, that's a brilliant return for them on their birthday, if we want to call it that, celebrations.
Yeah, it was better than Monza and Spa, I guess, but it was looking at times as though they were going to steal a result. I mean, Leclerc was the beneficiary of the yellow flag in Q3. He did wonderfully well just to get the thing into Q3 at all. And then he was going to be the beneficiary of the yellow flag because there were several cars didn't get there running, and he ended up in a very respectable grid place that flattered the car. And he was running in early third place, but the car was never going to have the pace to hang on to that. And he was a sitting duck, and it was picked off and knocked further and further back. And then it ate its tyres, and then he did an extra stop and. So, yeah, where they ended up was about where they were on merit.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Charles Leclerc, you look at him and you think, actually, he did a really good job in the race. And he still came home 8th in a race where a load of people crashed out. So that tells you how horrendous it's been for Ferrari ultimately. But I know we shouldn't be surprised, but I guess we hope for a little bit more given the performance sensitivities of this track. But yeah, what a horrible weekend for them. And of course there was a whole sideshow of Vettel announcing he was off to Aston Martin next year at the start of the event. And of course, if anyone wants to listen to us talking about that a bit, myself and Mark had a chat on a mini podcast, an extra episode that we released last Thursday. So if you want to hear about Vettel and Sergio Perez and Aston Martin, then head back to have a listen to that. Well, there was some good news for Ferrari, because Kimi Raikkonen picked up 9th place. I know it's not much, Scott, for a driver who's had so much success, but you know, it's the first points of the season for the old man of the grid, and it's quite good news for the team because it gives them an absolute stranglehold on that coveted 8th place in the Constructors' Championship. Now they've stockpiled 4 points,
and it gave them another class Ferrari win as well, because on track Kimi Raikkonen did beat the two works cars. Obviously he had the 5-second penalty for the pit lane entry infringement, which dropped him to 9th on the road. It will mean pretty much naffle to Raikkonen. It's important to Alpha, because it means they'll probably now get prize money for 8th instead of 9th or 10th in the championship. But to me, the big result, takeaway from that result is it's just more of an indictment of Ferrari's performance, isn't it? Like they're it's so off the pace. It's using it's slow. It's unreliable. Vettel keeps having he's had like 3 problems in 6 or 7 races now with the engine. It's eating up its tires. It's slow in a straight line. I'm struggling to find any redeeming qualities about this car other than the fact it had a nice tribute livery on it this weekend.
Yeah, and even then it didn't really work, because all it actually did was show why racing car colours have had to get a bit vibrant now in the television era, because it just looked like someone had turned down the colour. I love the fact they did it, and it was great, but it just looked like the colour had been washed out a little bit, unfortunately. So even that almost didn't work, although I should encourage all teams to do such livery experiments.
And there was another classy little Vettel helmet special, wasn't there, with the the sort of juxtaposition of the old style F1 car blueprint schematic type, and then moulding round into a modern day sort of CAD type drawing, and then sort of the combination of the two, the original Ferrari logo on one side and then a modern day version, like sort of split in two. So But that's, yeah, it's about as good as Vettel's weekends at the moment. The highlights are how cool is his crash helmet design this weekend, which is pretty unbecoming for a four-time world champion, but such is the situation that they find themselves in.
Yeah, well, all credit to Ferrari for bringing back a bit of retro performance in terms of lap times for this weekend. But yeah, it's a shame because, yeah, it's just, I think the thing that gets me is, yeah, we know they've got an engine weakness, we know they've got problems, but they don't even seem to know how to get the best out of it, do they, Mark? It's just not going well. And when they're finishing behind the lead Alpha on the road, as they did here and as they did in the final results the previous race, that almost means they can't have the get out of jail free card of the engine and say, oh, great car, terrible engine, because it shows that there's wider problems, doesn't it?
Yeah, indeed. And I think I get the impression they're all their development resources going towards next year and the year after. Next year, particularly on the engine, and the year after, of course, for the new formula. And I think it's just a sense of let's just get through this nightmare of a season and look ahead.
Yeah, that's actually the correct strategy, I would say. And in the past, Ferrari might have made the mistake of trying to salvage, I was going to say respectability, but I don't think they're even going to get to that level, even if they ace development for the rest of the season. But they are at least looking long-term and strategically and to get there for 2022, which the state of the hole they're in, that is absolutely the right decision. Now, obviously, that was the minor point. So it was Leclerc 8th, Raikkonen 9th, and then Sebastian Vettel 10th. And the kind of almost the opposite of a feel-good story of the race. I was going to say tragedy, but that's overdoing it a little bit. It was, of course, George Russell for Williams. He was on course for points. He basically had it in the bag, and then there was that second red flag, and then at the restart, wheel spin, he lost places, and he went on to finish 11th. That's pretty gutting. I spoke to George Russell after, and he basically said, well, I did everything that we wanted to do at the start, all the clutch positioning, all the power, everything was correct, but they just had wheel spin. And obviously he made the point that they're not used to doing starts on different fuel levels, which could have made a difference, you know, lighter car, maybe a little bit less traction. Perhaps that explains the wheel spin, but ultimately he'll be kicking himself anyway, Mark, because this was not only a golden opportunity for points, but he'd basically done all the hard work. So it's no surprise he gave out this sort of agonized howl after taking the checkered flag because he knew what he'd missed out on.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to come, isn't it? I'd be amazed if he remains pointless by the end of the season. But yeah, I mean, the standout moment for me for his weekend was when he kept his foot in as the car was going through the gravel, and he emerged out the other side to complete the lap, and it was still faster than his teammate, keeping intact that 100% record. That was quite a remarkable bit of control, I thought. But yeah, just it's not quite there, is it? But it's at least it's fighting. It's fighting for those positions on merit, which is massively better than where he was last year. So he is making progress. At least he can feel he's making progress.
Yeah, and it actually had quite a good the initial start, sort of charge down the outside of the first corner, which got him some places and kept out of trouble while various others were driving into each other. So yeah. I mean, he said it was a very, very good race, but you could tell he was really gutted that he'd missed out that, because he felt he'd have had the ninth place but for that. Although, in a way, he was slightly fortunate, because as Raikkonen came past him and moved across him, Raikkonen did actually hit his rear left into Russell's front right, which didn't do any damage, but it was just a little bit of an extra slap, shall we say. But another thing Russell did say was that both Grosjean and Raikkonen had that roll-around lap where they'd gone out to get the lap back, which perhaps helped them with tyre prep, maybe, but yeah, ultimately frustrating day for Williams overall. There is a little story that I don't think was seen so much. I was watching the onboards on replay just before we recorded the podcast, which is Roman Grosjean, who finished 12th, which was nothing to write home about. He had a great final standing start and got up into the points, but he was 60 points on downforce down in that race. And the reason being that when there was that collision on the first lap, which I don't think was his fault, he was minding his own business on the right side when Gasly kind of inserted himself into the rapidly closing gap between the Haas and the Alpha. But it pitched him round. I mean, it damaged the left side of the floor. Then it pitched him properly into the barrier. And so he sort of got on the radio and said, oh, idiots, all the usual stuff. And he said, oh, I'll get going, I'll rejoin. Oh, there's some grass to drive over to get onto the track. And then he's sort of driving around thinking, actually, the car doesn't feel too bad. I think he was expecting bits to be hanging off, because he had been driven into and hit the wall, but didn't even come into the pits, so he carried on. But I think that was quite a good race drive from Grosjean. He's one of those strange drivers, isn't he, Mark, in that there are times when there's certain things wrong and he seems to lose his head. But actually, he does a really good line in racing hobbled cars really well, which he's done for quite a long time.
It's unfortunate, isn't it, that he didn't get to ever hang those 2012 and 13 Lotus seasons. He wasn't able to continue the trajectory he was on because he's a very, very quick, devastatingly quick driver sometimes. He just doesn't have that consistency, and he seems to have lost consistency as his career's gone on. So yeah, he's always a bit of an enigma, and it's never a surprise when he turns up and is absolutely brilliant all weekend. And equally, it's not a surprise when he has a bit of a nightmare and looks mediocre, or does something stupid, or does something dangerous. You never know which Grosjean you're going to get in any given weekend. But this was one of his good ones, even though he finished a solid last.
Yeah, just one of those things. He's had some cameos this year. Silverstone qualifying, I forget which race it was, one of the two Silverstones. He turned in a magnificent qualifying lap, just almost out of nowhere. He's just one of those drivers who is mercurial, isn't he? But yeah, I think it's a bit of a shame that we're not going to see, I don't think we'll ever quite see the very best of him in Formula One, even though we did see hints of it with Lotus absolutely good enough to win Grand Prix, certainly, and came very, very close to doing it. But I just like the fact that he managed to just bring this car that had been assaulted and then flung into the wall and just kept going, didn't even come into the pits. That showed, I think people underestimate the fact he does have an amount of determination. He doesn't just wave the white flag all the time, which I think people think he does. He's one of those drivers who people look for his radio for when he's being a bit comedy and complainy, and they didn't really pick up on that fact. But 60 points of downforce, that's pretty major. He had a lot of floor damage. So yeah, that's one of the better 12th place and last places he'll get in his career. Let's talk a little bit about Mugello overall. This is the first time Formula One's raced at Mugello. Do we think it was overall a success, and would we like to see a little bit more? What do you think, Scott? Should we be going back to Mugello? Because it was, after all, just a stopgap venue.
I wasn't convinced. I actually thought at the start of the weekend that it made sense as a one-off. There's a lot of novelty value about it that meant the expected ills that came with it were sort of palatable because it was special circumstances and just the sheer spectacle of Saturday was going to be brilliant. And there were a lot of things about it that sort of just made up for the fact that the race was meant to be a bit rubbish. But actually, having experienced it, I'm pretty adamant that elements of this track contributed to that. The nature of where the start finish line is means that if you do have a safety car and a restart, it's probably going to get quite tasty. The first corner is brilliant for the start of a race because you've got a long run down there, so everyone's going to have a tow and it's going to go a bit mad. But then you've got quite a wide and awesomely profiled corner, which actually encourages a couple of different lines, which then feeds into a tight chicane. So you've got a recipe for it to all get jumbled up there. And because the DRS zone started a bit later, I don't think we had too many offensive DRS drive-by passes. I think we actually had a couple where they had to properly contest the braking zone. And like Albon's move on Ricciardo, for example, was a proper one where he had to really commit to it on the brakes on the outside. So actually, I actually thought it worked quite well. I would be more than happy for F1 to go back, but it won't, will it? Because no one's going to foot the bill for it.
Well, I presume it's got a bit of a chance next year because next year is going to be a strange season as well. And even though they're working on what they've described as a normal conventional calendar, I'm sure there's going to be some limitations. So you never know. But yeah, this was a celebration of Ferrari. And there is always that question of, yeah, where does the money come from? But ultimately, Mark, if this is the only time that F1 goes to Mugello, at least it'll be one of those memorable one-off visits, won't it? We're always going to remember that that crash and the two red flags. Only been a few races with two standing restarts after red flags. So it'll go down in history, even though it's just another Mercedes 1-2 in this era.
I'll be fondly remembered, I think, yeah. And because also just how fantastic it was to see the cars being pushed so hard through these some devastatingly fast corners, and just the beautiful part of the world that it's situated in, and just a very nice, slightly retro vibe. I mean, I was last there in the 90s, and it's exactly as I remember it. So, yeah, I think it'll be very fondly remembered if we never go back there again, but I don't think it's a given that we won't.
Mark, how does it compare to, how does it rank among the sort of rarer circuits you visited in an F1 context? Are there any other one-offs that you've done or circuits in that have held an F1 race that have only done like a couple?
I think really, no, that, how many times did we go to Valencia? I don't recall. That wasn't a great track.
I think it was five, but it felt, yeah. Valencia was one of those ones that there was lots of excitement about, but then it was just really disappointing when we...
what about like Korea and India and those sort of places?
Yeah, India was actually a really nice circuit. It wasn't in the greatest part of India, but it was, that was a really nice circuit, very characterful. Paddock facilities were a bit... rudimentary. the floors and the walls weren't necessarily straight, but the track was great. Korea, it was all right. Again, in a sort of funny hinterland setting. The circuit wasn't bad.
Korea has the makings of what I would consider to be the perfect Ed Straw Formula One venue, because it's just sort of, it's an interesting circuit and a place that nobody else really thinks much of. Everyone thinks it's probably going to be crap. And I can just imagine Ed absolutely loving it.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the Korean Grand Prix. I went to all of them. It was a
shock.
I just like the fact that they announced it as this big thing. They were going to build they were going to build a city around it. And there was going to be this great marina. And there was the street circuit section of it. It's going to have skyscrapers. And you get there and it's sort of is a sort of swampy field. There's some water and just nothing. It's just they didn't even finish the circuit. It was just a real curiosity. But it is great when you have these venues that are short lived. And you know, like I said, Mugello has never had a Formula. It's never even held a non-championship F1 race. So it's a nice little moment in the circuit history, if nothing else. But I hope we get another race there just to see what happens when we go back. I don't imagine we'll have quite such a remarkable race, though. So maybe we should be careful what we wish for in terms of that. And of course, we will have some other new circuits. One other new circuit coming up this year in the Algarve circuit, and of course the Bahrain Outer track, which is an old venue but a new track configuration. So there's going to be a little bit more of that to come. And certainly, I like the fact that the teams are confronted with something they're not familiar with. Well, thanks very much for listening. Head to therace.com and don't forget the hyphen as usual. Mark Hughes's race analysis, my ever controversial driver ratings. Scott Mitchell's currently forensically analysing every throttle input and brake input and steering input of that pile up to put something together so you can really understand everybody's role in it tomorrow, and you'll have all sorts of other interesting stuff. Check out our other podcasts, including the Gary Anderson F1 Show and Bring Back V10s, and our YouTube channel. Search for The Race there. Loads of video stuff for you to watch there. We've actually got a week off now after three races in three weekends and 9 in 11, I think it is. We have got a championship. We have got 9 races, and we're going to be off to Sochi next, but we'll be back this time next week for a slightly more reflective podcast talking about some of the other goings on in Formula One rather than these rapid fire run of races.